Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 135 of Registry Matters. Larry, you know, I always ask you about the weather, and I don't really ever want to ask you about the weather just to make small talk, but it's freaking hot in Albuquerque.
What is the official reading as we record?
Well, let me go back. It was 107 or something like that. When it's 109 now. So it's gone up 2 degrees in like the last half hour or so.
Well, it's humid. You know what? Well, thankfully not. But I tell you, you go out and lay yourself down on some asphalt at 109 and tell me what happens.
You will probably roast. You'd be like cook like an egg or something. You'd be a scrambled egg.
It's pretty warm, and the airport is the official reading station. I'm guessing it'll be a couple degrees cooler at the airport, unless okay. That is an airport reading. But still, it's steamy. But this is the hot time of the year for us. The latter part of June and the first half of July is the hot weather, and then we go into a monsoonal pattern where the afternoon showers roll in over the Sandias, and then we have. The effect of the monsoons, and it keeps the temperatures down for the remainder of the summer. The only problem is sometimes we don't have a monsoon season, and the prolonged hot goes on and on. But this year, I'm thinking we might have the regular pattern develop later this month.
I'm wondering if you have something along the lines of a I had a thought and then I lost it.
It's called Alzheimer's.
Holy crap. I had something super snarky and awesome to say to you, and then like poof, gone. Well, great. We're off to a good start. Maybe I should take notes. I should write down things as we start. Like if I have a thought, I should write it down. That way I don't forget about it.
That sounds like a great idea.
Do we have looking through the show notes for the night, Larry? I think we have a pretty neat little rundown of articles and things to talk about. I think that we should dive right in. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Now, what is this late breaking news crap silliness that you've put in here that you want to talk about?
What we're going to touch on briefly is the president of the United States used his executive powers to commute the sentence of Roger Stone. And I had so little knowledge about what Roger Stone had done, I asked you this afternoon to please tell me what he was convicted of doing, because he had been sentenced to 40 months in federal prison, and the president commuted that sentence, and that was just released yesterday evening, late Friday, which is a great time to release news that may be unpopular. But Go ahead.
Oh, well, he came under whatever the purview of the Mueller investigation and appeared before Congress, and they say he lied and he was convicted of lying.
I don't really like that type of conviction. I don't believe that people would, when you're given information about something happened in the past, it's difficult not to lie, because perceptions can differ on what happened, and a person may have a recollection that is, as far as they're concerned, that's what they remember. And I'm not a fan of that charge. I wasn't a fan of it when Martha Stewart was convicted. I'm not a fan of that charge, but that wasn't why I put it in there. I'm not here to even get into the debate about whether he helped was something that seemed like he was in the WikiLeaks and the fray of that when I glanced over the article you put in. But I'm not here to opine about that. I wanted to talk merely about the commutation. I disagree vehemently with the Democrat Party. So those listeners out there who say we never criticize the Democrat Party, I do it repeatedly, including tonight. I don't believe that Leader Pelosi or Leader Schumer are correct, and I think Pelosi has been the most vocal. I don't think that if anything we've learned is that the criminal justice system has a component of overzealousness, particularly at the federal level. So rather, if Leader Pelosi had done what I would have preferred, she would have said, Mr. President, you used your powers to commute the sentence of this person. And the Democrat Party has long since been concerned about overzealous prosecution and overreach of the federal prosecutor's offices, which you are, in fact, the head of. And what we would like to do is work in a bipartisan fashion with you, Mr. President, to deal with the systemic abuse of over-prosecution. I would have preferred that as a comment from Leader Pelosi than just saying that he was abusing the powers and he was doing all these awful things and making it a major political thing. Why not? Let's try to reform the system and see if we can get the President and Schumer on board. Trump has acknowledged from time to time that prosecutions are over the top. Okay, Mr. Trump, if you're really serious about that, let's see if we can do something about it systemically.
You don't think that there's something to be said for him commuting the sentence of his close personal buddy for like forever?
Well, you could get into the nuances of why he did it, but the point of the matter is he's allowed to do it.
Yeah.
That's a power that's enshrined to the president to commute and to pardon. And as far as I'm concerned, until someone can show me where there's limitations, there's no limitations contained in the Constitution.
I wonder, I would just like to think back, let's go back 4 years, and had Obama done something similar and commuted some personal friend, long time, whatever, you can imagine a certain kind of uproar of saying that, oh my God, this is the most corrupt president, something, you know, they would have just, you know, there'd been fires and torches in the street running around about it.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with you on that. There is a double standard. We have to accept that. The double standard, there are double standards on many things, and this is one of them. This president is not going to be run from office for anything that we think he should be, those of us, and I don't think he should be run from office. I think we've got an election coming up, and I think that that's the way to, if we disagree with how he's administering the United States as the chief executive, then we can communicate that at the polls in November. But he's discharging the office in terms of his executive clemency powers in accordance with the Constitution. Now, if he sold that pardon or that commutation in this case, if he's selling that, that's a crime in and of itself. That's what got Blagojevich put in prison before Trump commuted his sentence to time served and let him out. And Blagojevich is now a big fan of Trump, and he's also a member of the Democrat Party. But I do believe you're right. If Obama, I mean, look at the heat he took for any type of thing that let people out of prison.
Well, I'm thinking of Chelsea Manning. He commuted that sentence. That was like a 30-year sentence, and he commuted her sentence down to some number, like almost like time served, and she went home. And she's, as far as I know, and this is some time, but she's actually in jail now in Virginia or something for different kinds of charges, similar in nature, as far as I understand it. But he commuted her sentence, and I'm pretty sure there was a big uproar about it.
I don't recall the specifics of that, but I can say unequivocally is if you have a Democrat letting people out of prisons, there is vilification. There's less scrutiny, less vilification if it's a Republican, because a Republican would never turn loose dangerous people in America. A Democrat would, because Democrats are trying to get more voters on the rolls. They're trying to create a permanent underclass. These are right-wing talking points. These are things that I hear all day long. They're trying to create a dependent underclass, and they're doing things. They don't care about the safety of Americans. All they care about is votes, and that's their talking points. So Democrats are going to get vilified when they do anything that lets people out of prison. Republicans are not. I can't change that rule. That's the rule. That's the rule. So,
yeah. Did you hear that Michael Cohen had made his way back into prison?
I did not hear that. Tell us about it.
As far as I understand it, where he was, I don't really remember the details, whether he was at a food court at a shopping mall, but that doesn't sound right. Anyway, my understanding is, so he got furloughed because of COVID, and the terms, you know, you could explain this way better than me. So they say house arrest. I'm pretty sure that means house. Maybe if you're under house arrest, can you like go to the grocery store, or can you not? You have to have someone bring you food. I'm assuming you go to the grocery store.
And it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and house arrest program. But in the local program here, there's a very limited amount of out time that you can have for going to treatment and for going to approve things. But I don't imagine that what he was doing was approved, and that's probably what got him in trouble.
No, totally, totally. So, yeah, he was at some kind of restaurant, like having a family outing or something like that, and whomever it would be, probation, whatever handlers would be responsible for that. I guess maybe that's the federal marshals somehow spotted, and they got a tip, whatever. Anyway, so they said, hey, you're not following the program, and they sent him back. And I only wanted to bring that up just because, you know, a month, 2 months ago, you were like, we can actually furlough people and then recall them when the conditions change. I only wanted to bring it up for that reason that, hey, they furloughed this dude and they said, hey, come back.
Well, and I'm surprised they didn't have an electronic monitor. Maybe they furloughed enough people that they ran short of monitors. But you're correct. They can spot you. People that you don't know that know you also recognize you because of their involvement in the criminal justice system, particularly when you're high profile. And he could have been reported, and then there's so much surveillance tape everywhere, so much surveillance footage these days that it wouldn't be hard to go back and ask the entity, the business, to let us see your surveillance and prove that he was there, but I don't have much sympathy for him. I'm glad they furloughed him, but when they had him sign the furlough agreement, I'm fairly confident that it was clear in what the limitations of the furlough were in terms of where he could go and where he could be. And if he didn't value being in his own soft bed, preparing his own meals, being with whatever family members he had, and being able to select his times on when he gets up, if he didn't value that enough that he decided that he needed just a tad bit more freedom, they also have an alternative program for people like you that will not live within the confines of the greater freedom he had. I don't know about you.
What is this alternate plan? What is this alternate plan you're talking about? Hang on. I didn't realize there was an alternate plan.
Well, I think he's experienced that alternate program now. But when they presented him that paperwork and it said you can only be out 1 hour a week, if that's what it said, he could have said, no, sir, I will not accept release that only gives me 1 hour a week out. And they would have said, okay, you won't accept it. Well, we have an alternate program for you. You can stay here.
Better as a cruise ship?
You can stay here with us, and you can. But to me, any chance you can be at home in the confines of your own domain, I don't care how strict the rules are. I don't care how strict they are. It's better than being in a correctional facility. And when I say my home, I guess you could visualize someone's home that may be so horrible that a correctional facility might be better. But of all the homes that I've lived in my life, I would prefer all of them, even the mobile homes I lived in when I was a poor young fellow, I would prefer them over a correctional facility.
And I would imagine Michael Cohen has it's certainly not a ghetto. It might not be a $100 million mansion, but I bet you he's living in a pretty nice place. Just a guess. I have no idea. Just guessing.
So, according to the reports, the president offered him, not calling him, but jumping back, but on the previous story, he was offered a pardon, but that would be an admission of guilt on the Stone case. He was offered it. So he took the commutation rather than the pardon.
Just to run back through there, you don't have a tattoo of like Lincoln. You served in the Lincoln administration. You don't have a tattoo of Lincoln on your back, do you?
No, but I have many portraits that were painted while he was in the. Well, I've got quite a collection.
Like, do you have anything akin to like a selfie where you and him are photo together? Roger Stone has a Nixon tattooed on his back, which seems just so weird to me to have like Nixon. I can't think of a president that I can't think of anything that I would get a tattoo on. That's another conversation, but not Nixon.
Well, it amazed me because I looked at the wiki page and he's not that old. I mean, Nixon was elected in 1968. He was born in 1952, if I read wiki right. That is the Nixon administration. He would have been a very young man. So that is strange because it would be an early part of his professional career. When Nixon got reelected in 1972, he would have been 20.
Yeah. Yeah, so somehow he was influential, and he, you know, maybe it was some sort of drunk bar fighter. He lost a poker game and had to get a tattoo because of the poker game.
Well, Nixon was a pretty good president, all in all. So
until he wasn't?
Well, no, he was actually a good president all throughout his administration. I mean, he had a deep personal flaws as an individual in terms of his paranoia, his drinking, and his foul mouth and things. But in terms of what he did for the country, Nixon was not a bad president at all. You compare him with some of the other presidents, we got a lot of things out of Nixon. He was a liberal Republican by comparison standards of today.
Gotcha. Well, then let's start tackling some of these articles that we have. The first one coming from the Clarion Ledger. And the title here is that the Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves vetoes criminal justice bill. There seems to be this whole push about some kind of criminal justice stuff. Too many people are locked up. COVID, all these other things are happening. And somehow it just surprises me so deeply that Governor Tate Reeves would veto this. This is where we covered the whole riot thing and the cell phones were the cause. Maybe I should play that clip.
Oh, well, if you've got it handy, that is kind of funny.
No, I don't think I have it handy like that. How did this go down? Was this like super bipartisan, like right down the line? Like how did they here's how I was explaining it to a friend of mine. I realized that the governor is also elected, but the individual representatives, the ones that would write the law, they went through their whole thing and negotiated back and forth, and they put something on the governor's desk that their people had said that they wanted to have done. And what did the governor do?
Well, he vetoed the measure, and it had bipartisan support, but it was very weak bipartisan support. It had enough to get it to the finish line, but it wasn't hugely bipartisan. Now, and so let's be as fair as we can be. The Democrat Party of Mississippi is so weak, it can't pass anything without Republican support.
I'm surprised they even have one.
So the numbers are extremely lopsided in the Mississippi legislature, but it was able to, I'm guessing without doing the research, I looked at the vote count, but it didn't break it down by party. But based on what the governor said in the statement that we've attached to the show notes, he said that 2/3 of the Republicans voted against it in the Senate. Well, we did the arithmetic pre-show, and there would still be enough Republicans to get it to the finish line if all the Democrats voted for it. But what my guess is that this governor has political ambitions. He's only been in office since January 14th. So at the very minimum, he would like to be in office for more than one term. And since he's a relatively young fellow, I would assume that he has ambitions beyond possibly being governor. Maybe he wants to be in the U.S. Senate. Maybe he wants to be a president. Who knows? But okay. At his relatively young age, this is the beginning of his political career. I mean, as far as a higher office, he has served in the lieutenant governor's office and state treasurer. But at his young age, at his 40s, he's not going to say, well, I've been the governor. I guess I'll hang it up my cleats and be done with it. So my guess is that he did the analysis of the potential fallout, and he decided to veto it because he didn't want Willie Horton coming back to haunt him in the future. And Willie Horton is the what happened to former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis when he ran for president, and George H.W. Bush saddled him with the Massachusetts prison furlough program that they had in effect, which he had no idea. I'm sure he'd never heard of it until Willie did something bad. But I suspect that played a part in his veto.
Do you think that the way the bill was written and then signed, do you think that there was anything like particularly egregious in the whole thing?
I didn't really analyze that, but I don't think so. I mean, if you can do something bipartisan, it's usually been pretty well vetted. If you look at the legislative history, you know, there were four amendments. They were committee. I mean, this was pretty well vetted legislation. And I'm guessing, and Mississippi, if listeners to this podcast, if you know more, please let us know, and we'll either report it or we'll have you come on. But my guess is he just got cold feet. He didn't want to be. He didn't want to be tarred and feathered with this thing letting too many people out of prison. And he expressed, if you read the veto message, he expressed that he was okay with one felony being forgiven, but he doesn't like the idea of three felonies, if you see that in here. He says, for example, if it says criminals can get parole if they're convicted of crimes that could get them the death penalty. He objected to that. And another example, he says you're eligible to get out of prison at age 60 unless you're a trafficker or a habitual offender or a violent criminal. This totally eliminates those protections. And he said, I got countless calls from law enforcement and prosecutors. And you hear us talk about the, what do we call it, Andy?
The law enforcement apparatus?
Okay, so the law enforcement apparatus
right.
put a lot of pressure on him. And then he mentioned that that 2/3 of the Senate Republicans voted against it. So he's pointing out that it wasn't all that bipartisan. But I'm telling you, nothing gets passed in Mississippi without Republican support because the Democrat Party doesn't have enough numbers to do anything.
But okay, so the Senate voted, the final version was 25-17. I mean, that's a what is it, like a 60-ish 40 split, give or take? And then 78-29. That is a huge majority voted for it in the House. Like there was a decent amount of support for it.
There was, but I keep telling you, he is not looking just at those numbers. He's looking at Willie Horton.
Okay. And here's the other part of that is in the article. It says that the way that this thing is laid out says thereby reducing prison overcrowding. This would allow Mississippi prisons to seek parole and saving taxpayers $45 million. Mississippi is not exactly a wealthy state. That could actually like double their bottom line there, that $45 million. They probably have a budget of like, I don't know, $500 million or something.
Well, I doubt it's that high, but again, these savings come in the future, and people act as if, and we're going off on a tangent here, but people act as if the savings materialize. They don't materialize right away because of the prison industrial complex. When you reduce an overcrowded prison, say, let's do hypotheticals, you've got a prison designed for 1,100 and it's got 1,500 in it. If you bring it down to its design capacity, which you really don't want to run a system even at design capacity, but if you bring it down to its design capacity, you haven't saved a lot of money. You're going to cut back on food, the amount of calories you're going to put out there. But your basic operations stay the same. You're going to air condition to the extent you do. You're going to heat it to the same extent. Every post in the prison is going to still be covered. Same person, they're going to have people in central master control. You're going to have all these people in these positions. So you don't really save a lot of money. It's a hypothetical saving. So what people do, and it's totally disingenuous, they say, well, it costs us $42,000 per inmate or 36 or 29 or whatever. And then they multiply it times the hundreds of people that get out, and they somehow say that this will save us. No, it won't save us that. Let's be intellectually honest. Because there's no direct correlation in that reduction because the prison's fixed costs continue to operate. The personnel, you know, the positions still have to be covered. So the savings are negligible. The way you save money in a prison is you close it.
Yeah, so you would have to reduce the population by a facility, which could be, you know, 500 or 1,000 people or 3,000 people, and then you close that facility down. That would save you all of the monies.
It saves you that money, but then you get into new problems because, first of all, the people in that rural community where most prisons are located, right. these are deliberately driven to local communities because of it's only economic development they have. So you've got people who hate the government and they say they did this all themselves. And the only job they have is working at a government facility. And I've always found that ironic. But you're going to take away the lifeblood of that community if you close that facility. And then, as a compromise, you offer them to be transferred to another facility so you can keep their job protected. So then you take the 360 staffers that worked at that 1,200-unit prison and you disperse them around the correction system to the extent that they want to be dispersed, and you end up reducing net staffing by 42.
Yes.
So it's a little disingenuous, but I get your point that money would have been saved because even if you don't close a single facility, you have fewer medical calls, you have fewer outpatient treatments where you have to take people out. You reduce the prison population. It is going to save some food. It is going to save some money. So you would save some funds. But it's not as pronounced as what people that are on our side who advocate we're going to save all this money. They just do a simple mathematical formula, and then they say, well, if we reduce it by 400, that's 400 times 32,000. No, it doesn't work like that.
I gotcha. Then over at the State Bar of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Supreme Court police traffic stop did not violate the Fourth Amendment. Reading through this article, Larry, I don't know how they came to that conclusion that just because he had prior history, that gave them the ability, the reasoning, the probable cause to like search the car. I didn't see how that was. So this guy, he gets pulled over, and like when the cop comes back with the ticket, he sees that he has some sort of, you know, prior record, whatever. And he says he wants to search the car, and he doesn't. So Brown says he did not, but the officer's requested consent to search him revealed about 4 grams of crack cocaine and $500. So he says he didn't consent to the search, but the cop says,
well, but if you look on page, this is a long decision. I did not read it, but I did do a cursory glance. But this is the educational part of this, is to listen very carefully to what the officer says, and be having your recording devices running if you possibly can, because the parties dispute. Now look at footnote 2. The parties dispute whether Brown gave consent. Officer Deering testified that he asked Brown, "Mind if I search you to double check?" Because he'd ask him if he had any weapons or anything. And Brown, he says that Brown said no. Now Brown testified that he asked, could he search him? And he said no. Now there's a whole lot of difference in that question. You don't mind if I search you to double check? And if that's what the officer said, he said no. If that's truly what he said, then he gave consent. If he says, may I search you? And he says, no. Officers are very skilled at asking a question in the moment that you don't hear it the same way you're not picking up on the nuance of the question. Let's see how far back technology we go, what they call the dicta belt, before we had the fancy digital recorders and then the body cams and everything. Without having that, we don't know specifically what the officer said, but I would give the officer some benefit of the doubt because they're trained in how to ask a question to elicit the answer that they're looking for. So if he said it the way he said it, the guy did give him consent.
I believe, I'm looking for it really quick. So there is an app. I don't know if this fits under the purview of the podcast, but so I have it in the show notes and it's up on the screen on the YouTube side of thing. There is ACLU apps to record police conduct. So they have like quick response apps that you can click on your phone that will get you in there, get you recording the police as, you know, just quickly and easily so that you can, you know, obviously record what is going on and have your own personal record so you can say whether the cop did what they said they did or not.
Well, just for basics, if the cop pulls you over as an incident to a lawful arrest, they can do a full search of your person and of your vehicle. Now, the Supreme Court stopped them from searching your cell phone a few years ago. They said that requires a warrant. But prior to the point of being arrested, they have the right to do a safety check. Yes. And so they can pat you down, and anything that feels unexplainable, they can ask you and look at that, because you could tell them it's anything. You could say that, you know, it's a box cutter from the grocery store, and it may not be a box cutter. It may be something else. But it gets a little dicey here, because I've not trafficked in a lot of dope in my time. I don't know exactly what it would feel like, but I don't think it would feel like a weapon, would it?
No, certainly not.
Okay, so I'm assuming that the officer felt something that, based on his training, that would have led him to believe that it was unlawful, because he had $500, I think it said, in cash, and he had some substance. But that's not something that's not a safety issue. So I would have been on the side of the dissent, the dissenting judge here, that anything that he uncovered that wasn't a safety issue for him would have been the fruits of an unlawful search. He was allowed to do a pat-down search, but he did that for his safety, and he had reason to believe. I mean, I guess if a person's been convicted of what he'd been convicted of, I mean, it is not beyond conceivable that he could be armed, particularly if you're running drugs, you might be even more likely to be armed. But I don't think I would have gone this way, but I don't know that we can blame this all on the Republican judges, because wasn't it 4-1? So it looks like maybe some of the Democrat judges might have come down the same way on it.
The libtards?
Yep, the libtards.
All right, then. I'm going to let you have that one.
Well, just be careful when you're in Wisconsin, knowing that this decision has come down, you will be searched. The dissenting judge painted a correct picture. This is going to embolden officers to do more searching because they have been vindicated. So now this is Larry's general rule of criminality. If you are carrying anything illegal in Wisconsin, get rid of it. Don't encounter the cops because they are going to be able to search you now with a far lower threshold than what had previously existed. And this is the law of the state. Now, it is possible that Deering could ask for Supreme Court cert review because this is a federal constitutional right. And this is where I wanted to launch off of what we talked about last week when you talked about going into federal court. As a general rule, a state Supreme Court decision is final. And you cannot do anything else with it unless there's a federal constitutional right in play. And then you don't go to the trial court at the federal level. What you can do off of this decision is you can file a petition for cert with U.S. Supreme Court, and you can say that the Supreme Court of Wisconsin is wrong. There's a fundamental constitutional right, and you can ask the Supreme Court to grant review. But you don't start out at the lower court again in the federal system. You don't, when you lose at the state Supreme Court, you don't file a U.S. District Court case. And I think that's where you were struggling last week or the week before when we were talking about going to the district court. This would go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court on a petition for certiorari. And I hope our transcriber can spell that when it gets to be transcribed next week.
Probably not. Because it's hard to even figure out how to, even to pronounce the word, like certiorari. Yeah, got it.
Well, I hear it's certiorari. All sorts of ways. Cert is the short, yeah.
There's the other word that's amicus.
Yep, that is. But this could go up on a cert petition, and I would be, if it were to go up, this would be something that NARSOL, I can just about guarantee you, would be interested in it at some level. Maybe it wouldn't be a top priority, but how much privacy you have when you're stopped on the road, that would be an issue that we'd be concerned in about.
All righty then. Well, the next article is from the Associated Press. Maxwell moved to New York for Epstein-related sex abuse charges. So this is Jeffrey Epstein's longtime confidant. Ghislaine Maxwell was transferred Monday to New York City jail, plagued by coronavirus concerns and other problems, as she faces that she recruited girls, one as young as 14, for him to sexually abuse. Why is this here?
Well, I'm just hoping that she doesn't meet the same fate. This is not the same facility that Epstein died in, but it gives me pause for thought that something bad may happen to her. And again, just like I said about the police officer last week that was granted bail in Atlanta, this woman is presumed innocent. And that presumption follows her to the conclusion of the proceedings. And until such time as she's either found guilty or enters a plea of guilty, the presumption is she hasn't broken any laws and she should be entitled to be released. And I wish the police officer would come on the podcast and say what I just said about him, about her.
Right. Yeah, she's assumed innocent. But, we all know that this is not how this goes. As soon as you end up with all the press coverage and everyone's like, we should roast this woman. She's done these terrible things, but she's afforded her day in court, right?
And the presumption should be innocent. And particularly in view of this pandemic and her age, we should be doing everything we can to get her out of jail if there's going to be some reasonable accommodations made to assure her participation. And that's the same thing I said about the officer. It's the same thing I'm saying today. The only problem is he won't say it, and I just did.
Gotcha. There's an article that we have from JGTC.com, which is the Journal Gazette and Times Courier. Commentary: lawyers can't visit clients in prison, so quit monitoring their emails. I imagine this is about the people that have their email stuff in prison and all that stuff is monitored. But since the lawyers can't go in there, they have to do it by email. So shouldn't there be some sort of exception rule in the email software that says, hey, if something comes from this specific address, that it doesn't go through their filtering stuff? That seems like that wouldn't be that hard to do, Larry, at least me being like a systems person.
That's why I put it in here, because I know with lawyer calls, we try to make sure that we're not monitored. And if they use the regular telephone system and call us, they would be subject to the regular monitoring. But in most instances, they don't use the regular telephone system. They call by making an appointment with a case manager, caseworker, and then they're taken to a separate line. And we assume, by all accounts, it's not supposed to be monitored. You know, not being on the inside, we don't know for sure. But it seems like that they could figure out something. If the telephone calls were not possible to be made because of the lockdown and lack of personnel or whatever, and then the only thing they can do is communicate by email, it seems like to me that they ought to be able. And if I were an enterprising lawyer, I would be arguing this in court that there should be some sort of order issued for the prisons to figure out how to exempt these emails. And I don't begin to have any knowledge of how you would do it from a managerial and from a technical point of view, but it should be able to be done, I would think.
And I get that. So don't touch on those points, because technically it wouldn't be hard to do. But what would the resolution be now that the prison has potentially filtered, seen, whatever, those things have gone through somebody else's hands? What is the resolution once that cat, you know, the horse has already left the barn?
I'm not following the question.
Just that the damage is already done. You can't undo the damage that the prison has potentially already looked at the emails coming from the lawyers. So, yeah, you're arguing in court that this shouldn't happen, but what is the resolution, especially since it's already been done and they don't have any? I mean, think about it. In my mind, I'm thinking about it similar to the coronavirus thing. We don't have a process in place. So what are you supposed to do? Do something, but here is, they don't necessarily have a way to not filter the emails, but the damage is already done.
Well, I mean, if anything that was used, if anything that was communicated in email was used, you would move for suppression. You would ask the court to not allow that to be used. So if you communicated to your lawyer, for example, that through an email that you had committed the offense, you would, and the state says, well, we got you right here. You know, you hear of recordings that they play where they communicate to a loved one on the telephone. Mm-hmm. And what you would do in the case, if this was an attorney-client email, you would say that that's not admissible. And you would move to have that disallowed from evidence. But your point is well taken, that you can't unknow what you know as a result of mm-hmm. that screening. You can't unknow that. So what do we do?
I think an answer, Larry, is to have fewer people behind bars that these things would apply to.
We can't do that.
Okay. All right, then. I tried. That was my suggestion. I think you put this in here as like the funny article of the night. This is from The Appeal. Prisoners face undue punishment as their IRS claws back, as the IRS claws back their stimulus checks. Hey, you remember everyone got $1,200 a couple months ago?
I do indeed. I got my $1,200, and not everyone. Right. People who were, let's be clear. Okay. If you were wealthy and you earned more than $75,000, there was a phase out. When you reached $99,000, you didn't get any, and the same phase out if you were a couple, $150,000, and then there was the phase out. It phased out, so you didn't get it beyond a certain point. And then people over 16 and between 16 and 22, 23, so the college age kids didn't get it. So there were some exemptions, but almost everyone got it. I would agree with that.
Yeah. To your knowledge, and I'm sure there's an exception to this rule too, to your knowledge, do people in prison earn somewhere in that range, like less than?
As a general rule, I'm thinking that most prison jobs pay less than $75,000, yes.
All right, so those people technically would qualify for this money?
Well, I don't know that that's the focus of the article. This is more focused on people who actually had free world jobs, because it could be that since this money was given to you, in 2020, it was based on your 2018, 2019 returns. And these people, the prisons can be, you know, with the turnover in prison, the prisons can be full of people that were in the free world in 2018, either under some form of supervision. So they could be entitled to the money. And this is an example of our constant hatred for people in prison, that we just, the IRS issued a regulation, and I hate to tell the people who believe that this is a friendly government that we have in Washington, D.C. The IRS issued a regulation that said that we should treat this like Social Security benefits. And Social Security benefits are not paid to people while they're incarcerated. So you're entitled, you're entitled to the benefits. But back in the 90s, when Clinton was president and the Republicans had control of Congress, they passed that law, and Clinton signed it, where during the time you were incarcerated, you forfeit your benefits, and they incentivized the prisons to intercept the money. So how quickly the prison reports it determines how much reward money they get for the interception. And I don't know if there's a reward attached to this or not. I would imagine there is, but since I don't know that, I'm saying I'm guessing and I'm imagining. But if they modeled it after the Social Security intercepts, that's what's happening here, is the prison is being rewarded for intercepting these payments. And I would like to see legal challenges, because it's not in the law. According to the article, there was nothing expressed in intent by Congress, because a person happened to be incarcerated at the time, that they would be prohibited from receiving these payments. Same kind of thing that they did with the felon-owned businesses, the SBA, the Small Business Administration, who's handling the payroll protection program. They're not giving those to some small business owners who have felony convictions. Mm-hmm. And of course, now that's denying the employees of the felon-owned business from being able to have a job. I mean, it's detrimental to families that may have had nothing to do with the felony. But it wasn't in the statute. But these are administrative impositions that are coming from the administration. So I don't like it when people say we shouldn't criticize the administration. This is an administrative action that's being implemented by this administration. So this administration is fairly criticized for doing this. They issued the guidelines.
Can you describe what is happening with the checks that are coming into the inmates?
Well, the prison is, of course, you know, they don't let you receive checks, but they're holding the checks. And apparently the IRS is debating the return under that regulation that they issued, that rule that they issued, saying that they're not entitled to it. And that's what needs to be challenged. But as a general rule, again, for all the prisoners who are listening, if you're going to be asking for money from something, don't use the prison address. As a general rule, you do not want money sent to prisons, because there are prison systems who have it in the statute. They even say they were not going to intercept it and return to the IRS, but they will confiscate a portion of that for fines and fees and costs related to your conviction. I think Nevada has a fixed percent by statute that they will take. So therefore, you do not want a $1,200 check coming to the prison, because they're going to take their cut. Even in the best of times, without this intercept, they're going to take a cut. You want a $30 check coming to the prison. You want as little money coming to the prison as you possibly can, unless you don't mind giving the prison a cut.
Right. Yeah. You're going to pay certainly big fees. There's a, I don't know if it's JPay. I don't know which service it is that you, most of them have moved to for having your money sent in. Like, there's a handling company now, and then they distribute the money to your books.
Yeah, that's the good old private sector being creative. But I was talking about the state in Nevada. They collect it as to apply toward your fees. It's a statutory requirement that they may have JPay that gets their cut, but as in on the books of Nevada law, there's a provision that towards your fees that were imposed while you're in prison, we will collect a portion of all incoming funds to your account. Yeah. And that goes to retire those obligations. So that's what I'm telling you. Don't have money sent to a prison.
Certainly not. So it would be kind of like wishy-washy of if you technically qualify for it, since you're under the ward of the state. But so here's a guy that's detained at Coalinga State Hospital in California, who has one leg and uses a wheelchair. Because of his disability, he says the hospital has rejected his application for a paid job. So he wants to work in the prison, he says. The hospital gives him $12.60 per month, which has to cover toothpaste, shampoo, soap, and other hygiene products. And they confiscated his money.
So, now, again, I believe this is the IRS. I don't believe the hospital's keeping the money. I believe that under the guidelines, the money has to be returned to the treasury. It's like the dead people that received it. The IRS says they're not entitled to it. It's the IRS saying you're not entitled to this money. because of a proclamation that they've made. It's not the prison and the hospital, I don't believe, is benefiting from this. I believe litigation should ensue. Now, this is easy to say on the outside because I'm not the one in the prison who has $14 on my books and has no access to a lawyer. But there should be litigation because Congress did not prohibit you. There's nothing other than a regulatory invention by the Trump administration, by the Internal Revenue Service, that says we're going to withhold these funds from prisoners. Congress did not express that.
So it's funny to me. So does, like, if we are going to be textualists, since they didn't write it, then why are we inventing regulations?
That's my whole point. I am a textualist for this purpose. The text is not, does not. Textualism is really good at times. It's not so good at other times.
I'm about to call you a hypocrite. That's what it is.
Yeah, but I admit that when textualism suits my purpose, I'm for it. But in this case, if it's not in the text of the law, and it isn't, according to this research that produced this article, if it's not in the text of the law, then it's an invention. And I do not believe inventing things. If I'm going to be a textualist, then I need to be consistently a textualist. And therefore, that's not in the law. You shouldn't be inventing this.
Gotcha. And then an article from Bakersfield.com. Attorney, now sick with COVID-19, says judge ordered her to court against her better judgment. I got to think that going to court when you are testing positive for COVID, like, you would unnecessarily potentially infect people that are visiting the courtroom, the people working in the courtroom, potentially the judge, potentially your client, and or if you're a prosecutor, the defendant, like, all that. Like, so that sounds like a bad idea. I mean, like, even the Supreme Court's doing these things over phone or Zoom or something like that.
Well, I hate to put on my rose-colored glasses, and I have... I'm in a consternated condition, if that's a word. When you're a judge, you have extreme obligations to try to give people justice, timely justice. So you've got rules bearing down on you for speedy this and speedy that, and you've got the pressures of trying to keep the docket moving, and you've got a lawyer saying, "I've got the snivels today," and I'm minimizing it because that's not what she apparently said. But the lawyer is saying she's not feeling well. And a judge is saying, "Well, you better get yourself here to court." And then she says, "Well, I've been tested for COVID-19, but the test results haven't come back." Well, looking at it through the rearview mirror, probably we would have said, "Well, should you've been tested for it, you must think you might have it. Therefore, be on the safe side, abundance of caution. I'm gonna say you don't have to come to court." But the part that's missing that we don't know would be, would there have been any adverse consequences on the case where she was representing the person? Was there a deadline about to pass? Was she willing to sign a waiver of that defendant's rights for whatever process was bearing down to take place? There are so many unknowns in this, but a judge should, if an attorney says, particularly if that attorney is not notorious for lying, and the people out there listening say, "Well, all attorneys are always notorious for lying," but that's not true. But an attorney who has a reasonably good reputation for telling the truth and being straight up with the court, he probably should have canceled the proceeding, but there are circumstances where you're up against deadlines. If a person's being held on a charge and there's a 10-day rule that you have to indict them or release them, and you don't get that hearing is for the purpose of determining if they're going to be indicted, and you don't hold the hearing, and that person has to be cut loose, is that a decision you'd like to see made?
Yeah, I do wonder what's going to happen in hindsight of how many people have not had their due process and their speedy trial and stuff like that. How much of that stuff has just been, "Oh, sorry, you're going to be like 6 months delayed now because of," like, wow. I wonder how much stuff is going to get started. How much shit's going to get started from that?
So I wonder that myself, because it seems like it's going to cause some convictions to be questioned in the future because of this pandemic and what it's done in terms of the process. The accessibility to lawyers, the confrontation of witnesses, the in person, you have certain rights, and those, as Mike Pence is fond of saying, those constitutional rights don't go away just because of a pandemic.
Right. Okay. So doesn't that apply to the whole criminal justice system as well?
That's what I'm trying to call Pence out on. You know, he's fond of saying that Americans don't forfeit their constitutional rights. So I think that would be universal across the board, that people charged with crimes don't forfeit their rights either.
You don't think that there would be some hypocrisy if you were to then ask him directly, hey, does this apply to the criminal justice system?
I think there would be, because all through the 2016 campaign, they were so adamant that Obama had never called out. He's supposed to call terrorists terrorists, and they said because he wouldn't use that name, he wouldn't call them names. You know, and Obama said that's not an effective policy just to call someone names. But then when this administration took power and the protest in Charlottesville, very hesitant to call them out, And I thought that calling names, calling people thugs and stuff, I thought that's what you were supposed to do. So I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy there.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. And then over from, I guess this would be Time Magazine, time.com, want to reform the criminal justice system? Focus on prosecutors. Hey, over at the Decarceration Nation podcast with Josh Ho, who's a fairly frequent guest over here, he interviewed a conservative former prosecutor from the CPAC convention, and that he was like all over that, saying that if you want, like, the prosecutor has so much control over how things are pushed down the pipeline for the criminal justice system. So here's another here's an article that describes this.
Well, I think we covered that in the last podcast about the DC Circuit Court of Appeals on the Flynn dismissal, but the judge has appealed on that.
Okay.
So it's kind of going off topic here, but on the three-judge panel voted 2-1 to tell the prosecution to tell the judge that the prosecution has the final say, and I think that was the correct decision, and I said that last week. And now Judge Sullivan has asked for a review en banc, and he's going to get the whole DC Circuit to try to overturn the panel.
How about that? Well, they mentioned in this article Larry Krasner in Philadelphia and another public defender that are just totally in favor of focusing on the prosecutors for criminal justice reform efforts.
Well, they're not the only player, but they are an important player, because you can pass all the laws you want to, but if a prosecutor doesn't make it a high priority, nothing's going to happen. But the flip side of that is, if you give them powers and you give them resources, they are going to prosecute things, usually, if it's there, because they're going to say that's the duty that they swore to when they put the hand on the Bible, and they're going to do that. So prosecutors have enormous power, but ultimately, criminal justice reform is going to require us to make some decisions to limit the powers that they have. If we don't want as many prosecutions, we're going to have to limit their resources. And I'm not saying defund them completely. Defunding is a concoction of the right wing to try to scare people, which, if you're watching, I meant to put together one of the Trump ads he's running about when you call 911. And it says, press 1, and we'll get back to you in 5 days. And if it's a murder, you know. And I told people weeks ago that's exactly what they're going to do. But we have to limit their ability to bring prosecutions if we don't want so many of them. And we do that two ways. We do that by not having so many laws, not having so many felonies, and by them not having as many people on their payroll. If you take a prosecution office that has 100 prosecutors and you reduce it to 64, theoretically, only 2/3 as much work can come out of the office. If you were able to produce the same amount of work, what that would tell us is that a third of the people weren't doing anything to start with.
Yeah.
But that's the part of it. So you didn't defund the office. You reduced funding to the office. The same thing with the police. We're not going to defund the police completely. Nobody is advocating totally abolishing the police. We're talking about directing some of the resources that are going to law enforcement to people who might be able to handle non-police matters that the police get stuck with handling. The police get stuck with handling things that they just assume not handle. We're talking about redirecting some of those resources towards alternative intervention other than law enforcement. And maybe we won't have so many cases brought, because the police, when they come out on things they really don't like to come out on, finally their parting words are, if we have to come out here again, someone's going to go to jail. You've heard that, right?
I've heard it used, not me personally, but I've heard the expression.
Yes, if we have to come out here again, somebody's going to jail. And they mean
whether anybody's guilty of anything or not.
They mean that. So if we have people where their powers are not, if I have to come out here again, someone's going to jail. If they have different cafeteria of options, they say, if we have to come out here again, we're going to seek familial counseling for this family, because clearly you guys are having some difficulty relating to one another. That doesn't introduce that person to the criminal justice system, and it doesn't bog down the jail processing somebody and take a police officer off the street to deal with that. So that's what we're talking about. You can buy into all the scare tactics you want to, but nobody's talking about abolishing law enforcement.
Well, okay. Over at the BBCnews.com website, U.S. Supreme Court rules half. Oklahoma is not a small state. Half of Oklahoma is a Native American land. Now, this, I can see everyone's eyes rolling in the back of their heads like, why are we covering this? But turns out that the person that like got this whole case pushed up to the Supreme Court happened to be convicted of a sexual offense. And I guess he said that, hey, this is federal land and you can't try me at the state level. And I think that's how the process ended up going to the Supreme Court.
There again, I didn't read the entire decision. I did a less than skim read, but that's what it appears to be, that Oklahoma, that half of Oklahoma is not a state land. Therefore, the state court verdict is invalid.
That's really quite humorous in the whole grand scheme of things. But then there's this tiny little sliver on the map in the top right corner that wouldn't be considered the Indian Nation. Forgive me, I don't know what the right word is. Native Americans, forgive me. That wouldn't be Native American territory up there in the corner. That's kind of funny that there's this tiny little spot there in the northeast corner that wouldn't be Native American land.
Well,
but what's interesting to me is, so the person that wrote the decision is Neil Gorsuch, and he kind of comes up in on our radar fairly often, but he is super duper textualist and said that the United States signed these treaties with these organizations umpteen hundred years ago and they are not honoring them, and it says what it says, so we have to do what it says.
Well, I again, sometimes textualism is a good thing, and if we don't like it, we can go back and negotiate with the Native American tribes, whoever they would be. I think it was talking about the Seminoles, but whoever we would have to negotiate with, and we can try to figure out how to remedy this. But our highest court has spoken. This is Indian territory.
Yeah. And it says, so because Congress has not said otherwise, we hold the government to its word. And it's only a 5-4 decision, which I do sort of find interesting in the grand scheme of things also.
Well, what's the split? Who's on the five and who are the four?
Ah, you had to ask that. I don't know who
bunch of darn liberal damn do-gooders is all it is here, mumbo jumbo.
It says Justice Neil Gorsuch, a conservative appointed by U.S. President Donald Trump, sided with the court's four liberals and also wrote the opinion. So that's there you go.
That is really disgusting that these liberal pointy heads would align themselves with. I put it the other way, that a good conservative would align himself with these liberal Obama and Clinton appointees. That's really, really disgusting.
All right. Well, we're done with all that. And Larry, you have decided to treat us with your, you've concocted some plan to teach people how they can get off the registry, to navigate their registry obligations to be removed. So you have 5 minutes before we go to the voicemail message. Begin.
Oh, I thought we were going to make this a major segment.
No, I'm just kidding. You have all the time in the world. And I've put together some questions. I'm sure you have some things that you could throw around. So what are we talking about here as far as a, like, what does this mean, removal from the registry?
Well, we're talking about in those states where there is a process that exists to petition to be removed from the registry. Now, we're not talking about the states where there are no process. I can't give you what there isn't. And we don't want to confuse this with, if you don't think you're covered by the registry, that is not the same petition process. You might move from state A to state B, and you've looked at the laws of state B, and you don't believe that that state B encompasses your conviction from state A. Well, the process you would file then would be a declaratory action asking the court in state B to declare that you're not covered by state B's registry. We're talking about a process where a state has said, after you've met these requirements, you can ask to have your registration obligation terminated. So that's what we're going to be talking about. And we're going to be talking about in generalities, mostly, in terms of what you should do and what you shouldn't do and what the considerations are. And we're going to take the questions that came from the patrons and the listeners and from you. And I intended to write up some, but I think we're going to have a good, and we can keep coming back to this because this comes up. I must have gotten 36 emails last week about getting off the registry after the podcast about from people wanting to know, how do I get off?
Well, I mean, you constantly say, so while you're under supervision, you have limited blah, blah, blah. And most of the people that would potentially be listening to this or that, you know, just on the registry in general, you know, hey, it's not a forever thing that you're, well, for, sorry, Mike in Florida. Yes, it is a forever thing, but you know, you're not under supervision for forever. So you do probably come up at some point that you could get removed from the registry. That's where that's the timeline that we're talking about, that this would begin, is when you are eligible, what should you do? Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about in states like Georgia, Arkansas, where they have in many states, several states have, but California will soon have a process. And I'm going to be getting my facts together in terms of what's so bad about the process. And we're going to be talking about California in more detail. But tonight we're going to focus on the states I'm more familiar with, which are Arkansas and Georgia. And I put the removal process in Georgia in the Dropbox. So what we've talked about it on NARSL in Action programs, but we always have new listeners and we have new questions, and there's basics that you should always do and basics you should always not do. And then specifically for your case, I'm not going to be able to tell anybody about what I would do in your case unless I'm on your legal team, but I can tell you these general things that you should do to get prepared.
All right. Well, then let me throw the first one out there. Should you do it pro se?
I never recommend anything as serious as this being done pro se. And it's not because I work in the law business. It's because I understand how the law, the adversarial system works. The adversarial system is based on having an advocate for each party. And as a party to an action, you don't want to try to be your own advocate, because the opposing party isn't going to want to deal with you. And I don't make that rule. All I do is communicate to you the reality of what the rule is. You're going to have to deal with an adversarial side of this process, and they do not want to deal with you. They want to deal with the person who represents you. They can't talk freely to you. They can't tell you what a creep you are if they think you are, because it's probably not going to end well for the conversation. They can't tell you things that you need to have done that you shouldn't have done and things that you ought to do that would enhance your odds. So I'd never recommend you do this. Is it allowable? Yes. In most instances,
pretty much everything is available. Right?
It's allowable to go pro se. I never advise it, because if you go pro se and you botch it, and the referee doesn't call foul on some things, and the referee's not supposed to call foul, your advocate's supposed to call foul. If the referee doesn't call foul, you may set yourself up for a long time of before you ever get a chance to come off again, or you may not ever get off because of something that's led into evidence it shouldn't have been, that judge is always going to remember because there was no objection made. Don't go pro se.
Where do you does this happen in the county of conviction, or could it be anywhere else? And you know, Louisiana's parishes. So translate that if that's relevant to you, or does that vary by state, or do you always go back to, hey, I'm from, you know, Pionono County, so I go back to Pionono County?
The schemes that I've looked at, that's the way they do it. I don't agree with the way they do it. I think that this is a little off point, but I think that the process of getting off the registry should be more professionalized, and you shouldn't have the haphazard approach. If you have a county that has 14,000 population and everybody knows everybody, and then you have the county, let's pull Fulton out of our hat in Georgia, which has over a million people, where nobody knows anybody. And it creates a whole different paradigm. So I would prefer, if I got to design a system, I would prefer that there be a specialty court in each state that deals with this among other specialized issues. But the reality is that in most of the schemes I've looked at, you file in the court you were convicted, and you'll be before the judge. If that judge, he or she, is still sitting, that judge will determine if your petition is granted. If you happen to have moved to another state, you file generally in the county where you are residing, which gives you an opportunity to do a little bit of forum shopping, because since you are not forbidden to move, Georgia has 159 counties. You could do a little bit of research and decide statistically where you would have a better chance of being removed, and you could plant yourself in that county in Georgia if you had an out-of-state conviction. But if you're convicted in Georgia, you can move to any of 159 counties, and your petition is going to go back to the county you were convicted, to the very same judge. And if that judge is dead or retired, the judge who has succeeded in that bench, who's sitting in that division, that judge is going to make the decision.
Do you think, like, super broad stroke, do you think that in that type of situation, that moving to a population of 10 county or a population of 10,000 county would be a better idea? Or, you know, pick, you know, 100,000, something like that. Super rural or super populated? Which one would be more favorable, do you think?
Well, it runs the gamut. There's no absolute rule. The more important factor is going to be how oppositional the prosecution is going to be, because if you read these processes, the petition always gets served on the prosecutor among others. So in Georgia, they're referred to as the district attorney. In Florida, they're referred to as the state's attorney. In Michigan, they're referred to as the prosecuting attorney. But you're going to file it on the people's attorney, which is generally the they are elected. So the more important consideration is, what is that prosecution's office's posture going to be on these petitions?
All right. Someone asked on Twitter, and this may fall slightly outside of the scope. It says, let's say someone was put on the registry in a state for 10 years. The 10 years is up and they're removed. What obligations remain when traveling to other states or internationally?
Well, I'm going to try to duck the international, but on the state, the obligation on the state is to determine if your crime is covered in that state. Now, again, we're going to talk about hovercraft. If you have been terminated in state A and you move to state B, barring the hovercraft, state B is not going to be getting a handoff notice from state A. If you're a registered person, you're going to have to be handed off, because most states, before you leave, you have to tell them that you're moving to state B. They send state B a notice to be expecting you. And then if you don't check in with state B, they're going to put out a fugitive warrant for you, and the federal marshals are going to be notified that you didn't check in with state B, and they're going to start looking for you, and that's not going to be good because they're going to find you. But if you were to hypothetically move to state A, from state A to state B, having been discharged in Georgia, and state B is Alabama, let's just keep it really close together. So Georgia discharges you. They have absolutely no power over Alabama. So the minute you become a resident of Alabama, your duty to register is absolute, because Alabama law says specifically that there – that regardless of the date of conviction, regardless of anything, so Alabama has defined you as your Georgia conviction as a covered offense, and you have a duty to register. So the question would be for Alabama, how quick are they going to figure out you're there? Well, if you do like McGuire did and you go knock at the sheriff's door and you tell them, I don't think I have to register, they're going to know fairly quickly.
if you don't go knock at the door and don't go say, I'm just curious now, I got off the registry in Georgia, do I have to register? If you don't do that, you could live the rest of your life and never have a problem, depending on how often you encounter cops the remainder and how old you are. If you're 72 and you don't encounter cops very often and you live to be 81, you might go 9 years and never have any more problems the rest of your life. But what you would do if you were discharged in Alabama, in Georgia, and you went to Alabama, you would let your conscience be your guide. If you want to go register, you would go register, because your research, if you do it diligently, you'll see that each state defines a sex offender differently and who they cover differently. And if you don't want to have any possibility of hovercraft, then you would check in with the state and say, I think I'm just wondering if I have to register here. And more than likely, they're going to tell you yes, even though you've been discharged, because Georgia's discharge has no bearing in Alabama.
Because we have 50 individual little countries in their sovereign places.
That is correct. And Alabama chooses to require lifetime registration with no removal process that I'm aware of.
Gotcha. Well, so that would take care of the another question that came from Twitter. It says, what about states that put you on the registry for life and there is no way or process to be removed? Are you just effed? Like, just close up shop, go home?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you are in that particular state. You're screwed until the point you can get the state to have a removal process. But there's nothing, as far as I know, we don't have any states that have walls around them. Do we?
you could probably answer that better. Do you have any walls, even at least on the southern border of your state?
Well, yeah, but that's not a state-to-state wall. That's a nation-to-nation wall.
I know.
But as far as I know, that you're free to navigate these United States without any interference.
You could pick up shop. You're not on supervision, so you just say, yeah, I'm still going to be on the registry here, and so I can move from Alabama to whatever, Wyoming, Wisconsin, pick a W state.
Well, you can reverse the process we just talked about. You could be registered in Alabama for life or Florida for life, and you could move to Georgia, and you could petition to be removed if you meet the Georgia criteria, and Georgia can relieve you of the obligation to register. Now, I know you're going to tell me that Florida keeps you on the registry for the rest of your life, and I don't need to hear that. I've already heard it 1,000 times. But that doesn't impose any obligations upon you. You don't face prosecution for going to pick your kids up from school. You're not prohibited to go to a public swimming pool. You're not restricted in where you can work because you're listed on the Florida registry if you're in Georgia. All the things that cause you potential harm are not there, other than the fact that somebody who does a Google search may find that you at one time were listed on the Florida Sex Offender Registry. But you tell them, well, that was a long time ago. Yes, I did have a sex offense in my past. And yes, they've carried that. I mean, that lives in perpetuity. But I'm not registered today. I've got that. That's a chapter of my life that's closed. And I wish Florida didn't keep you on the list. I wish they did, but that's what they do in Florida. So you Floridians either change that law through the legislative process or find some constitutional challenge. I don't think your constitutional challenge is all that good. And I've told the Floridians that, although I don't agree with them keeping you listed, as long as it's a truthful statement, you were registered in Florida and you were convicted of that offense. Is that correct? That is historically true. Okay, so if they suppress the address, if they're putting an address that's still is no longer current, but if they put living out of state and they put whatever Florida conviction you have on the website, that is historically true. That is not a constitutional violation until either our statutory laws evolve to make that information no longer public, or until we have some evolution in the courts where they decide to legislate from the bench and create a right to privacy that says that after a certain period of time that your past is no longer your past and therefore it can't be disclosed to the public. But until then, there's not a constitutional violation.
Okay.
That should give me plenty of hate mail this week, shouldn't it?
Yes. So crackpot@registrymatters.co. Do you think that it's wise to get a psychosexual evaluation before trying to do your removal process?
It is critically important to do that. Again, it's not required by law in most instances. It's not required by law. But we're not talking about just what's required by law. There's a lot of things that I would tell you if I walked you through it that are not required by law, but you should do. A psychosexual evaluation gives you something to present to both the prosecution and to the judge for the judge to hang his or her hat on to justify your removal. And I mean, I know that the state evaluators, they're just splendid and they're just the most objective people you could ever find. But I prefer to have my own. I prefer to have a doctor that I have employed that I can call and I can ask questions and I can send the patient, the client back if something, if a test isn't clear to me. I prefer to be able to say, Dr. Gatlin, I would like you to take another look at this because in view of what I know about this person, I think that you could dig a little deeper for us. And this would be more helpful. We don't ask the doctor to render the opinion that we're looking for. We ask the doctor to look at things that the doctor may have not looked at. And then sometimes the doctor comes up with a different answer. And I prefer to have a psychosexual evaluation to counter what they may have, because as we go through the process, and I'm going to walk through it once we get through these questions of what I would do, that is something that you would want to do. And if you can't afford it, I understand that. That may be an option that's not available to everybody, but if it's something you can do, you should do it.
How much do you think they cost?
Thousands. Anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000. Yeah, you could be spending a couple thousand to $5,000 on a psychosexual. Well, is the registry as bad as you say it is?
Well, I was just going to say, you're probably like in cahoots with someone that does them and you're pocketing some referral fees or something.
Oh, nope, not at all. I think I should be, but see, we don't have a process here, so there's no cahoots to be in, but it's just to up your odds of success.
I was talking to Paul Dubling at, I guess it was the Houston conference, and asking him, and he's like, look, all I'm trying to do is throw this, you know, binder of 100, 200 pages on the judge's desk to provide him with cover so that he can say, hey, look, here's the reason why I made this decision. He had all this. He had this in his favor. He's active in the community. He goes to this church. He's, you know, all this stuff. He's walked puppies across the street. So as far as I know, he was a good human being, and my conscience was relieved by letting him off.
I agree with Paul, and Paul Dubling and I very seldom disagree, and I agree with that completely. You want to empower the judge, but there are steps before you get to the judge. But yes, you want to give the judge as much as possible.
How do you find someone, because, you know, this is sort of an esoteric space, how do you find an attorney that is competent to represent you?
That is difficult, but you employ me to help you. That is how you do that. Someone that will tell you things you don't like to hear, and you pay me to help you. And actually, I don't charge for that unless I have to make a special trip. But I have on occasion. I think you remember the case in Georgia where I worked on an appeal where we got a guy's conviction set aside, and I actually traveled to Georgia for him, with him.
In Texas now, I believe?
Yes, that person. Okay. Yes. Well, you have to know the right questions. This process as law is open to anybody. If you're licensed, you can do anything that the law allows you to do. So if you're a licensed attorney, you can practice in any area, but just because you can doesn't mean it's wise, nor should you. And when you get a drunk driving, when you get a DWI, DUI, whatever they refer to it as in your jurisdiction, you may find that there are attorneys who do DWIs for $800 or $1,000, but that doesn't mean that that's who you should go with. You need to find if they're competent enough or not. And so that means asking the right questions. So the first thing you want to find out from the attorney is how many of these petitions they've done. So when you call them up and say, I want to talk to you about being removed from the sex offender registry, and they say, the what? You probably
walk away.
Probably don't have the right attorney, even if it's a family
how
friend.
How does it sound again?
But when you say, well, I'd like to petition to be removed from the sex offender registry, they say, you want to do what?
do what? So I already asked you about what kind of price range would you expect to pay for an attorney to do this? So you already said something like $3,000 for a psycho.
I would be surprised if a competent attorney would charge any less than $2,500 to $5,000 because of the work that's involved.
Wow.
I will guarantee you this. If we had the process and it's a gatekeeper in this office, I wouldn't quote anything less than $5,000. But I would actually do the work. I mean, we could quote a $200 fee and do nothing. And get people to pay us $250 all day long and say you lost, but in order to do the proper work, that would be a justifiable fee. So I would expect it on the low side. You might get a fee quote of $2,500 to $5,000, and then there's the variables of your unique circumstances. If you're in, Valdosta, which is right on the state line, and your conviction is in Forsyth, which is the county north of Atlanta, rather than the city of Forsyth, and your attorney that you like in Valdosta is going to have to travel up there, so you've got travel related costs. But assuming that it's semi local within a 50-mile radius, then travel's not going to be a big factor. But you've got a lot of steps are involved. The first thing that I'm going to do if we had such a process is I'm going to collect as much information from you as I can about you. And people are very reluctant to tell you their dark secrets about what they did. In some cases, it's decades ago, and they may not remember everything, but people are reluctant. But I'm going to find out as much as I can about this offense and about you and what you've done over the last few decades. And I'm going to find out how much the prosecution hated you at the time. If you know about it, I'm going to try to find out how that office felt about you and how they treated you. And were you high profile? Because believe it or not, prosecution offices keep files. It may come as a surprise to some people, but even though the very person that handled your case may not be there, they still likely have a digitized file or maybe even a paper file on you. And since it's going back to there, I'm going to find out as much as I can. And then I'm going to make a journey to the prosecution's office. And I'm going to say, this guy has been a stellar character for the last 32 years. And I'm going to be bringing a petition potentially to get him off the registry. What is this office position going to be? Because I don't need you $5,000 if they say, we fight like hell on every one of them. And everyone that we have opposed has been denied. I kind of know right there that I'm not in good I'm not in a good position. And then if they said, not to mention the fact that this guy was a pain in the you know what, and we hate him as much now as we did 25 years ago, then I'm going to come back to you and say, well, you know, I did my preliminaries and they oppose everything in that particular jurisdiction, and there's only been one out of 72 petitions granted. And you can actually get those statistics from the administrative office of the courts. You can actually find out every different cause of action. They code it with a type of petition that was filed, and you should be able to get those statistics. But even if you can't get it from the administrative office of the courts, as a practitioner, you should be able to query your defense listserv and ask people who practice in that area what the ratio is. You need to know that information about who's getting off, what judges are doing what with these petitions. And what the DA's office position is going to be on your client. You don't care about anybody else but your client, what their position is going to be. And depending on their position, that tells you how much work you've got to do. Because if you have any chance of winning, you better come in there with what Paul Dubin described. If their posture is to be opposition on everything, you better come in with a very good psychosexual evaluation. You better come in with a very strong candidate for removal, because the judge is going to be hesitant if the prosecution is fighting tooth and nail.
And the last one that I have is, how long do you think it takes to put this together from, you know, even roughly like from the time that the initial contact with the lawyer, getting your counsel on the finding the right one, to then submitting the packet, to getting the judge's calendar? And how long do you, is that a 2-month process, 6 months, 5 years?
I would say 6 months to a year. And again, it's going to vary according to the jurisdiction. If you go to a small jurisdiction where the docket's not particularly heavy, they can probably schedule a hearing faster. But how fast it is not important. I mean, but it's important if you're never going to get off. If something's never going to be decided, then that doesn't do you much good. But you don't want a 60-day turnaround. Expediency is not the issue. What you want here is thorough preparation to go to this hearing. and you want to be as prepared as you possibly can be. And if the judge takes some time, that's generally a better thing for you, because if the judge is going to deny you, it doesn't take a lot of time, because in most of the cases, let's just take a look at what the Georgia statute says. A judge doesn't have to decide much to deny you. Let's read verbatim. I think I put a copy in our folder, didn't I? For the Georgia removal process?
You did. You put a copy in.
Yes, did. I did. So,
it's
so
in Dropbox.
Okay, so the judge, after the hearing, it says in considering the petition, the court may consider, now listen to this, any evidence introduced by the petitioner. Now listen to that word, it says may consider. Doesn't say shall consider. The court may consider any evidence introduced by the petitioner, any evidence introduced by the district attorney or sheriff. So the sheriff is also a part of this in Georgia. And any relevant evidence. But the key word there is may consider. There's no shall there. And it says the court shall hold a hearing on the petition if requested. Now, that's pretty clear. You will get a hearing if you want one. And it says then the court may issue an order releasing the individual from registration requirements or residency or employment restrictions in whole or in part if the court finds by preponderance of evidence that the individual does not pose a substantial risk of perpetuating any future dangerous sexual offense. Now, again, listen very carefully. What that says is that despite everything you presented, and it says the court may issue an order. Now, if I had my rethers, I would like for that to say, if you prove by preponderance of evidence, which I don't like the offender having to prove it, but I think that if you have shown by preponderance of evidence, I think that this should say, rather than may, it should be shall issue an order. But this is what it says. It says may issue an order. So therefore, when you have this hearing, you want the judge to have as much time as he or she needs to make that decision, because it's a may. And I'll relate it back when I used to be in property management, when I used to make decisions on who was coming, and I had a weak applicant, and I was thinking about whether I should rent to that person or not, and they would put pressure on me to make a decision. They'd say, I've got to know something. And I'd say, well, you know, if you really have to know something, I can give you an answer. It's not going to be one you'd like, because I am contemplating your case, your circumstances. I'm still trying to reach out to your 14th cousin or whoever that reference was that hasn't called me back yet. And I'm still cogitating how I feel about you. And you don't meet our criteria. So you're asking me to make an exception. And I'm going to make the exception when I'm ready, if I make it at all. And if you're telling me you have to make a decision, I can give you a decision today. I have a feeling that the judges are going to feel the same way. if they're in a conundrum about what they're going to do, whether they may release you or not, I don't believe putting pressure on them for a decision is going to be a good thing to do. It's not going to increase your odds because of the word may. Now, if it said shall, I would feel differently. But I'm only going by what the law says in Georgia. And we are textualists here on Registry Matters, aren't we?
No, we are not only that. just to sharpen the question that I'm asking, though, about the timeline, I'm not trying to say, hey, we're going to try and push the judge to come up with I'm just trying to set up some realistic expectation of
six months to a year. 6 months to a year.
All right.
Yep. So I think
to give the attorney time to prepare the things, to get on the docket, to get the judge time to do all those things, an answer.
So it begins with research. I've got to find out about you. I've got to find out if you're eligible, meaning that statutorily if you're eligible. Sometimes you might like to be removed and you're not eligible by the statute. So we've got to figure out if you're eligible. If you've got any integrity, you're going to tell the person, I'm sorry, you're just not eligible. You haven't met the requirements to be removed. But if you're statutorily eligible, then the journey to the prosecution office has to take place. It's not required. I'm only telling you this is what we would do, because we need to know what they're going to say. And the best way to find out what they're going to say is to go talk to them and find out what they're going to say, rather than speculating on what they might say. Now, you can get a pretty good clue what they might say based on what they are saying with the other petitions of a similar nature. But that doesn't tell me what they're going to say about you, about how much they don't like you. I can only ask them, and trust me, if you're pro se, they will not tell you in all likelihood what they think about you. So that's the big disadvantage of being pro se. You're not going to find out really where your opponent stands on this. We need to know where our opposition is and what buttons and levers they're going to be pulling. We need to know if the sheriff has got a dossier on you saying things that has concerned them during your period of registration. We need to know that before we get to the court hearing. That's not a good thing to spring. That's not a good thing to spring at the last minute. We need to know all this stuff.
Well, those are all the questions that I could come up with my little pea-sized brain.
I think those are great questions. I think those are great questions. But if you can go pro se, I mean, if you have to go pro se, it's hard for me to say do that in the alternative, because if you don't file, we can be fairly certain you won't get off if a petition's required. And if you can only do it pro se, the worst thing you could have happen is you'll end up in the same position you're in now, which is still registering. So I'd guess you can do minimal harm. But what if you have this hearing pro se and stuff comes out that shouldn't have been allowed to come out? I don't know how we undo that if you do it pro se. Just,
right. I do understand.
So, but I hope that people who are contemplating the removal will prioritize it in terms of economically. Yes, it's expensive, but being on the registry is expensive. Not because of the fees. I mean, the fees are $50, $100 or whatever.
Disabilities and restraints, which
right,
is your favorite
right.
expression.
Well, the economic hardship of there are employers who will not hire you if you're on the registry because the insurance company will not condone that practice. And the same employer would have hired you with that same felony if you weren't required to register. That may be the difference between a $7.25 an hour job and a $19.50 an hour job. So therefore, it might be worth it.
I think an economist would call that an opportunity cost.
Yes. And of course, if you don't have the money, again, I don't have a solution for that. That's a downfall in the process that we have. Our processes are not designed for indigent people. This is one of the pitfalls we have in this country. We don't do a lot. This is a quasi-criminal proceeding. It goes back to the criminal judge in most instances. And yet it's a civil proceeding. The registry is a civil regulatory scheme. It could be argued that it's a criminal proceeding. Therefore, since you're going before the criminal judge, but the judge would say, well, I said it's a civil judge in this matter. This is a civil matter that's related to your criminal conviction. But I can understand if you don't have access to any funds, it would take a lot of plasma donations to raise $6,000 to $8,000. I mean, I don't know what it pays these days, but it would take
quite a few. Let's call it $50.
Well, it would take a while to raise thousands of dollars at $50. And how often can you do plasma donations anyway?
I don't know. I've always considered that if somebody is doing that, then you have probably made some poor decisions leading up to that point, and because you've got problems. If that's how you're going to make money, is selling biological fluids.
I think it's a couple of times a week, but I know that when I managed over near the university, they would run ads in the student newspaper and they say like you could earn like $180 a month or something with the extra spending cash, and that was a long time ago. But I have no idea what any of that stuff does. Thankfully, I haven't had to resort to doing that. But people do it, and thankfully they do it because it's needed.
Yes, yes, yes. All right, I don't have anything else on that. So are we ready to hit these two voicemails and get out of here?
Yeah, we are, because we're over time already.
We are way over time. All right, so here's the first one. And let me just put this book in. This is that if you're going to send us a voicemail, please don't ramble around the subject and try and be concise and clear. Maybe type it out and read it. Somebody left a voicemail and they were kind of all over the map. He had to call back. Oh, I forgot this. I can't put all that together. So, with that said, here is voicemail number one.
Hey, Registry Matters. Hey, what's up, everyone? I forgot to leave my name at the last two messages. This is Brian from New York. My next question is along those same lines, too. I've been offered jobs over the past few years. Most of them are for traveling to different states to, like, build fixtures, you know, fiber optic technician going state to state. My question also would it be a heavy burden that I have to, in order to go to these states to do these jobs, I would have to register. And then with these registrations in different states comes restrictions, which might interfere with my job, which might interfere with me, you know, doing commerce. because I have to work around these things. Now, like I said, I know I'm not going to go to a state and get into any trouble, so I don't expect to have any police contact. But, or however, you never know with certain things. So I would like to know, would that be any grounds for a legal standing? Thank you, FYP.
Different states have different requirements of once your boots on the ground in there before you would have to register. Like Georgia, I think Georgia's kind of vague. It's either 7 or 14 days, depending on how you want to read it. And Florida's 48 hours. So everybody's got their own rules. Is that what he's asking?
I was thinking he was going a little deeper than that in terms of what if he registers while he's working in a state. Are the restrictions that they're imposed on registrants applicable to him? And yes, the answer is, unless they're exempt, unless there's an exemption for a temporary resident, everything that's applied to someone who's only going to be there as a resident for a briefer period of time, the same restrictions apply. That was the way I took the question. And his point was, does those disabilities or restraints constitute ground for a lawsuit? Because if, say, for example, he has a job, and I'm pulling this out of air because I didn't talk to him personally, but say, for example, he has a job and the job is in an exclusion zone and he got offered that job, but the registry won't let him do that job. He's asking if that's grounds for a legal action. And yes, it is grounds, but the likelihood of success, you'd have to evaluate carefully in terms of the body of the case law of that state. You know, what has the state Supreme Court ruled on similar challenges? Have there been any? And then is there a federal constitutional claim? Would you be better off to take it at the federal court to begin with? So we don't know until we'd have to dig into the particular type of restrictions and how disabling they were to him in terms of his job. And the state would have plenty of defenses. They would say, well, we didn't ask him to come here, and he can do other jobs other than this job. I mean, it would be as all litigation is when you're making constitutional challenges. It would be difficult because the presumption is in favor of constitutionality. But yes, that would be something where there would be, it would not be so laughable that you would not get admonished for breaking the complaint. Can't say your likelihood of success though. I don't know. I love the accent though. When you compare that with my smooth Southern drawl, and then you have one like that. So he's got
from New York. Hey, this is Brian from New York. Forget about it.
So,
and I do a terrible rendition of
that. Well, yeah, he probably gets a kick out of my Southern drawl as much as I did out of his.
Probably, and he's probably like, "What accent?" All right, then one from Jeff.
Hello, Larry and Andy. This is Jeff from Kentucky, and July 15th, 2020, a new law goes into effect that is affecting registrants around here. It says, well, it is called Kentucky House Bill 204, and it says that that registrants may no longer live within 1,000 feet of publicly leased playgrounds, and that's something different than publicly owned playgrounds. The interesting thing about this law is it's not being applied retroactively, and it even says that if you already live somewhere, you don't have to move. And as far as public playgrounds are concerned, if one of those pops up, or a school or a daycare, you do have to move. And I'm interested in that because normally the interesting thing about this bill is that they're not applying it retroactively, and you don't have to move if you already live somewhere if one of these things pops up. I guess my question is, why do you think they worded the bill that way? As in, why are they not applying it retroactively? Because when they passed the law saying that registrants could no longer be in parks in 2016, they did apply that retroactively. As in, like, I was convicted in 2015, so I thought one day I would be able to go to parks again. But they passed a law saying that I could not go to parks and applied it retroactively. What is a publicly leased playground, and why did they not apply this retroactively? And as always, FYP.
Both callers tonight said FYP. I love it.
I have no idea what a private playground is. I would guess it would be something like in an apartment complex, but without more information, I don't know. But the answer, why did they not apply it retroactively? I guess they were being cautious about constitutional challenges, because more and more constitutional challenges are rendering retroactive application of various things unconstitutional. All you have to do is take a look at those versus Snyder and on and on and on. So, and they are in the Sixth Circuit in Kentucky, I think. So I think that probably would be the answer to that, would be that out of constitutional concerns that they didn't apply it retroactively. But then I thought he said something in there that they were applying part of it retroactively. So I was a little confused because he said
talking about a previous law, though.
Yeah, but if you play that again, I think at the very beginning he said that part of it was applied retroactively. But my speculation would be because of concerns of constitutionality.
Okay. All right. And how about that accent?
That's more to my liking.
Well, there you go. So that wraps up another marathon show, Larry.
That's right. We've had a good one. Hopefully we'll get a dozen new patrons next week. We haven't had any new ones to report for a while.
So quickly, hey, you can go to registrymatters.co and you can find all of the show notes and all of the information from there. And that's all I got.
Good night, Andy.
Good night, Larry. Have a great night. Talk to you soon.